for the discussion on air quality, in particular the minimum emission standards, focusing on the postponements that the industry has submitted to the department and those that have been considered. So today's meeting is about that and tomorrow as well. So we thought we need to arrange this in a form of a workshop so that we can understand the subject much deeper. We have structured the program in such a way that we will be receiving an input from a prof. We consider the prof to be an expert in the field, so he is going to give us that input, and we must extend our sincere thanks and appreciation for your presence here to share with us information around the subject. And we have also decided to invite the NGOs who are working on this matter of air quality, those that we normally interact with. We have scheduled them in a program so that they can be able to give us their presentation. We have also invited the industry to come and give us a briefing. So we hope that the two-day session will be able to cover adequately the issues that as a portfolio committee we want to interrogate. I've got an apology here from the minister, who's got a meeting in Pretoria with the AG, and she will be flying after the meeting. So she might join us. She might not join us, depending on her availability when she arrives here. So that is the only apology that I've received. I wonder if there's a... I see there's a full attendance, at least of those members who are attending. Those who we expect that they will be here all the time. The others, we don't know. They might come. They might not come. But nevertheless, let's proceed with our meeting. In terms of our program, we will then take this opportunity and invite Professor Gerrit Cornelius from the University of Pretoria, as I said before, to then give us an input on the minimum emission standards, the origin, effectiveness of implementation, constraints and opportunities for securing full compliance. So I don't know whether you'd want to make a presentation seated there or... Okay. All right, Prof.
Chairperson, thank you. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. The people who tried to teach me public speaking made a rule that you can't start with an apology. So I apologize for doing that. I'm not a professor. In my nastier moments, I say that is because the university doesn't recognize talent. But the truth is probably that it's because I haven't spent sufficient time in academic life. I've been into the academia and out of academia again, and I think that probably is the reason. So I have more than, let's say, not just academic experience on the subject. I have spent time in industry. I have spent time in consulting practice as well, all of it on air quality. And if I state some obvious points here, again, I apologize. I've tried to build this up from very basic principles. And maybe I can get the computer to listen to... No, I'm sorry, Chair, it moves on my screen, but it doesn't move on. I thought that I'd start off by talking about what the object of the Air Quality Act is, as the Air Quality Act itself actually says. It refers to Section 24B of the Constitution that I think we are all very familiar with. And taking from that, it says that the object of the Act is to protect and enhance the quality of the air in the Republic. And I'm going to define what that actual quality of the air means, but then the Act continues to say that reasonable measures should be provided for preventing pollution and ecological degradation, and then it also says securing ecologically sustainable development while promoting justifiable economic and social development. So it seems to me what the Act has in mind is that the protection of the environment is almost tempered tempered by certain other factors as well, which I hope to go into just now. Quality of the air, again taken from the Act, says this refers to ambient air, and ambient air is defined as all the air that is not regulated by the Occupational Health and Safety Act. So if you're talking about air quality here, what it means is the quality of the air in the community. In other words, what the community out there breathes. Not the employee in the workplace, but community, the air that goes into the lungs or that affects the community. Then one has to say, well, to be able to deal with that, you have to have some numbers. How do we define or quantify that ambient air standard or that ambient air that we're trying to protect? And that has also been done in terms of the Act when the air quality standards were published. And now my pictures have gone. Here I had a table that gave the ambient air quality. Yeah, you see now all the illustrations are actually gone. And maybe I should just work from the... I apologize there. Now you have the picture of the university building as well, which is supposed to be there. Now I need to go to the...
Maybe, Prof, you are referring to some of the pictures which are on our packages.
Yeah, if I have don't updated have the presentation, Chair. I have updated the presentation considerably, though. Okay. So some of the pictures might still be relevant, but the argument is slightly different. So I would ask that we provide the members of the committee with an updated version of the presentation, not the one that was sent.
Okay, that's right.
So if we talk about ambient air quality, the ambient air quality standards define what ambient air quality means in numbers. I was not given all of the gases here. I think probably most relevant to our discussion this morning is the standard for sulfur dioxide, for nitrogen dioxide that is given here. and then for particulate matter, PM10, and then subsequent to the standards coming out in 2013, there was an update on particulate matter for PM2.5, which is two different classes of particulate matter. But these, I think a couple of points are relevant here. The exposure standards here, and these are community exposure standards, I must again repeat, are given for different time frames, and obviously then the numbers change and there's allowance made for frequency of exceedance, and if you do the numbers, that means the frequency of exceedance allowed by these standards is about 1% of the time. So what the standard says is that if you conform to the standard for 99% of the time, then you're legal. You're allowed a little 1% exceedance there, and I don't think we need to go into the reasons for that exceedance allowance. I don't think it's relevant to the discussion. The other aspect that I just need to point out is that for PM10, we've actually had an implementation schedule. For PM10, you can see that we had one standard that was valid until December of 2014. 1st of January 2015, another standard kicked in. And for PM2.5, which is the finer particulate matter, that subscript 10 and 2.5 means that's a micron size, and a micron is a millionth of a meter, so that's really small stuff. And the rule of thumb is that the smaller the particulate matter gets, the more toxic it is. So for PM2.5, if you compare the limit values, you'll see that for PM2.5, they are typically much lower than for PM10, but also we have a different implementation schedule. We had one standard until the end of 2015. Then we have a standard for a second period in which we are now from 2016 to 2029. And then the final standard hopefully kicks in by the 1st of January 2030. And I think the reason for the department giving that implementation schedule is, if you'll excuse the pun, particulate matter is particularly hard to address because there are multiple sources of particulate matter. For a lot of the other pollutants, we are fairly certain about where they come from. They are emitted from point sources. But particulate matter, and particulate matter is really engineering speak for smoke or dust, if you must have a common language term. There are a large number of sources of particulate matter. So we have the industrial sources, but you could consider even a farmer plowing his fields in August on the high veld with that huge plume of red dust behind his tractor as a source of particulate matter. The burning of bush in Zambia and the Democratic Republic of the Congo in August and September gives us some particulate matter in South Africa. Some of that smoke actually comes down to South Africa at times and contributes to particulate matter. So there are a large number of sources. I was just giving one or two examples, and that is why I think the department decided to give an implementation schedule, because there are a lot of issues in addressing particulate matter. This diagram tries to give you the relationship between emissions and ambient air quality. So that is a picture of a factory. In fact, this diagram was given to me by somebody in the aluminium industry. So you have air pollution being generated inside those buildings and being emitted from the ventilators in the roof, for instance, or even from the windows in the building, and we call those fugitive sources. But we also have, in a number of industries, simply a stack from which a plume arises, and that we call a point source of pollution. But both of these are blown downwind, and as they blow downwind, they mix with the surrounding atmosphere, and eventually the pollution goes down to ground level, and then those sources that are indicated on the diagram cause ambient air pollution at ground level. The objective of the Act is to regulate the quality of that ambient air on the left-hand side of that slide. One of the tools that are available to do that is to actually regulate the sources. And that is what we are talking about here. So if you can just get your mind around what the relationship is between what is being emitted at different levels in the atmosphere, but our ultimate objective is to give society out there, or the citizens, good ambient air, and we have a number of tools to manage that, and one of those tools is to manage the emissions from point sources and from fugitive sources. So I've given a summary of the air quality management process as I see it. The first thing I always say to the students, if you were to be appointed the air quality manager of the city of Tshwane, what is the first thing that you would do? And they say, well, maybe I'd order some nice office furniture. I say, no, that's not what I mean. I mean, technically, what would you do? And then the first thing that you have to do is to do a baseline survey of what the ambient air quality in your city looks like now when you start the job. And you compare the numbers that you get from that survey, and there's a number of ways of doing that survey. You can do direct measurements, but there are also some mathematical techniques, we call that dispersion modeling, that are available to actually do such a baseline survey. You compare what you find from the baseline survey to the ambient air quality standards, and if there is conformance, then you can go away and take a holiday. But next year you have to come back to make sure that there is no deterioration. But in most South African industrial areas, you will find that there is no conformance. At least some of the components will exceed the national ambient air quality limit values. And then the next step in the air quality management process is to identify the sources that contribute to that exceedance of the national ambient air quality standards. And then, of course, to prioritize those sources, because you can't, especially in the priority areas, you cannot deal with all the sources at the same time. So the next step then is to prioritize those sources as in the order in which they contribute to ambient air quality, and then start managing those sources. And then, yeah, you have to implement the reduction plan. And what I've given here is a 30-second summary of a process that will take 10 or 15 years in practice. This is, for instance, just an example of a baseline survey that the city of Johannesburg did many years ago using fairly simple apparatus for both sulfur dioxide and for nitrogen dioxide to identify the areas of the city where ambient air quality standards were being exceeded, and then to identify the sources and start managing the sources. This is the basis of any air quality management plan. And then how this diagram I put together a couple of years ago, just to try to explain how one then deals with the sources. So what we have here is the ambient pollutant concentration given vertically and a timeline given horizontally. And that red line is where we want to be with regard to ambient air quality. When you start the process, there are going to be areas where there is non-conformance with the ambient air quality standards, typically industrial or urban areas. But there might also be some areas where there is already conformance with the ambient air quality standards. The approach of the Air Quality Act has been to say, well, the first step must be to apply reasonable emission controls to all the sources in South Africa, really, because they are national minimum emission standards. And what those reasonable standards are, we'll discuss just now. Once you've done that, then obviously there is a reduction in the ambient air quality concentration. So you can see that yellow line has actually shrunk. The green line has also shrunk. Because if you apply a certain set of emission standards to everybody, whether they're in a conformance area or not in a conformance area, then air quality is going to improve. But you might find some areas where even with the application of the minimum emission standards, the reasonable standards, there is still going to be an exceedance. And typically that would be in the priority areas that have been identified in South Africa. And then as a second step, you need to apply additional controls to those sources in the non-conformance areas. And then hopefully we get to where the whole country meets the ambient air quality standards, and the job is then to prevent significant deterioration. So if we can now go back to what those reasonable emission standards are, one of the sectors that is addressed in the Air Quality Act, or one source category, is what we call the Section 21 emission limits, which apply mostly to industrial sources. And the Act says the minister must, or in a province, an MEC may, well, that hasn't happened yet, so we can disregard that for now, the minister must list certain activities, and a consultation process is prescribed in the Act for actually listing those activities. And once those activities which have an effect on air pollution have been listed, the minister must set emission limits and a monitoring protocol to determine whether the limits are being met or not. And then once that has happened, then people that are listed require an atmospheric emission license to operate. And Section 21 requirements, the regulations were first published in April of 2010 and became law in April of 2010. The licensing authority is the metro or the district municipality, or where the district municipality does not have the capacity, province can step in, but I think in the major part of the country it's now the metros and the districts doing this. There is just the proviso that for national priorities, actually the department can become the licensing authority, and then the license has contents. One of the lines or one of the pages in the license will be the emission limits, which are applicable to that specific operation that the license is issued to. And they may be, by default, the minimum emission standards, but they could, in fact, be stricter than the minimum emission standards if that is a requirement in a specific area in order to meet ambient air quality standards. Chair, am I going too slow? Should I speed it up? So this is an example. Yes, Chair. This is an example of such listed activities. There's a table that has the numbers on the allowable concentration of certain pollutants, and the pollutants differ from activity to activity. The specific one that is on the slide now is for major power stations. So this is large boilers used for steam production or electricity production. So those would be applicable to Eskom and to Sasol. And at each pollutant, you see that there is a standard for new plant and for existing plant. And it's actually quite easy now to define those. New plant is a plant that was not running on the 1st of April 2010 when the regulations came into force. And existing plant then, by default, is a plant that was actually running on the 1st of April of 2010. The Act then says, now before I get to that, let me just say a number of these categories also have some text below the table which are part of the standard, and in this case, for instance, the standards require the big power stations to have continuous emission monitoring for the components that are listed in the table. But the text also differs from category to category. Just new and existing plant standard, the Act, the regulations, when they were first published in April of 2010, said existing plant actually has 5 years to meet the existing plant limit. So there was a 5-year grace period to meet the existing plant limits. That means on the 1st of April 2015, all the listed activities in South Africa should meet the existing plant limits. plants that came online between 2010 and 2015 by default would meet the new plant limits. And then the Act said, after another 5 years, that means by the 1st of April 2020, existing plant must also meet the new plant limits. And in some cases, there is a major difference. I'll just point out to you, for instance, sulfur dioxide in the middle line. The standard goes from 3,500 milligram per cubic meter to 500 milligram per cubic meter. And so that is a considerable step change in requirements. And for some of the older technology, that requires considerable expense to actually meet those standards. For instance, the major power stations, retrofitting to meet that SO2 standard will typically add 20% or so to the cost, to the capital cost of that plant, and maybe 15% or so to the operating cost of that plant, which eventually will then reflect in the electricity tariffs or in the price of the product that such a facility sells. When the discussions about the activity started, I was involved in putting together such a list, and I've put that list, or the first draft of the list at least, and what I can remember of the terms of reference I've put on this slide. It said, the department said to us, all processes scheduled under the old Act, APA, the Atmospheric Pollution Prevention Act, should be included in the Section 21 list under the new Act. Categorization was slightly different. Under the old Act, it was by process. The department said, no, now we must do it by industrial sector. The department said there shouldn't be technology forcing. In other words, we give numbers for the emissions, but we shouldn't prescribe technology that should be used to actually meet those standards. For new plant emission limits, we should use the principle of BPEO, which is best practicable environmental option. And I've just given the definition, as is given in NEMA, for that best practical environmental option. It says provides the most benefit or causes the least damage to the environment as a whole at a cost acceptable to the society. And we said, well, that actually means that you have to do something like a cost-benefit analysis when you select these limit values. But time pressure at the time precluded a formal cost-benefit analysis of all those limit values. So what we had to do, we mostly based the limit values for new plant on European Union, in some cases United States emission limits, using that BPEO definition. But those obviously refer to European or United States conditions. There was our initial list included that proposal for the 5 years to meet the existing plant limit values, and then a final version was produced that was eventually published. It also included that requirement for existing plant to meet new plant requirements eventually. In other words, within 10 years of the promulgation of the regulations. I just need to go back to the relationship between emissions and ground level concentrations, and I have taken these figures from the Vol Triangle Priority Area Report that came out in 2009, because I think they provide a good illustration. In that report, 5 so-called hotspots were identified. Those are areas where where the ambient air quality standards are being exceeded. We know that they are being exceeded. So I've taken 2 of those hotspots. One is the area that is marked 3 there, which is the area around the ArcelorMittal steel plant in Van der Bijl Park. And this slide is a bit of a busy slide, but what it does is, for different of the pollutants, it gives the main emission source in the left-hand column, and then in the middle column, it says what those sources contribute to the short-term ground level concentrations, and in the right-hand column, it gives what those sources contribute to the long-term ground level concentration. And the reason why I put up this slide is just to show the difference between the size of the emission and the impact of that emission at ground level. For instance, for the top line, SO2, the huge red portion of that diagram is SO2 emissions from the iron and steel industry, which is obvious in that area. It's the ArcelorMittal factory. But if you look at the ground level concentrations, the factory only contributes about 25% to ground level concentrations, because that is the emissions are at a different level than some of the other emissions. Typically, the steel industry has very tall stacks. The SO2 is emitted at very high level, and there's some dispersion that happens before that pollution gets down to ground level. Some of the other sources of SO2 that are also listed, we can look at power generation, or the purple one down is domestic fuel burning. The purple, the 27% on the top left-hand side of the diagram. Thank you very much. So if you look, that 27% there is almost invisible there. So it is a very small portion of the emissions, but still domestic fuel use contributes 27% to the SO2 at ground level, although the emission numbers are quite small. They're almost negligible compared to industry. And the same for the long term. Just to illustrate the point a little further, if you look at PM10, the smaller industries contribute about 27% to the PM10, but their contribution to ground level concentration is something like 62%. So there's no direct link between the size of the emission and the contribution to ambient pollution at ambient level, and that is because the sources have different characteristics. Some of them are very high, some of them are hot, some of them are cold. So the point is here that that direct link is not there. And just to hotspot number 6 in the priority area is actually the residential area of Soweto. And there one can see the same. If you look at PM10 again, it says that particulate matter emissions are caused something like 70% or 69% by vehicles. But the ground level concentration, 69% of the ground level concentration is actually from domestic fuel burning. So that's just the point I think that I need to make here, that not a direct link between the size of the emission and the impact at ground level. This point is also illustrated by the Highveld priority area. These diagrams were taken from the Highveld priority area. The red areas on this slide are where the ambient air quality standards are predicted to be exceeded. And for SO2, you would expect the areas around the power stations and the area on the Highveld as indicated here. This is the area around Emalahleni. This is the area more or less around Kendal Power Station, but also north of the city of Tshwane, and then in the residential areas all over Gauteng, the standards are predicted to be exceeded, although there are no big high-level sources of SO2 there. These we expect, because there are large high-level sources of SO2 from the power stations, from industry, and so on. But here, we don't expect those SO2 exceedances, but we still see them, again, because of domestic fuel use. And the reason why, although the sources are small, they have a high impact is because they're at low level. Typically, people have an informal stove in their backyard or even in their houses, especially in winter. And for PM10, it's the same. In other words, PM10 is the visible stuff, the smoke and the dust. We expect these exceedance areas around Emalahleni with the industry that is there, but we don't expect in the residential areas, and yet we see a lot of smoke and dust in the residential areas. And here we're referring to impact, not the size of the source. The impact is large because the sources are typically at low level, and I sometimes say this to the students, these sources are in your face. Well, actually in your backyard, not in your face. Relative contributions to health impact of air pollution. I just thought I'd refer to this study. This is the most complete one that I know of. This was by Lim and about 100 other authors, and the study was published in the journal Lancet in 2012, and this looks at the burden of health all over the world and then ranks the different impacts on health. And it does that by region. And for our region, which is southern sub-Saharan Africa, they in fact have eastern and western sub-Saharan Africa. It was broken down quite, but this we sit in the southern sub-Saharan Africa in that study. Ambient particulate pollution is ranked 25th of the burden of health impact. There is also high blood pressure and heart attacks and all of these other, obesity is there and so on, they're on the list. But air pollution related, particulate pollution, ambient particulate pollution is ranked 25th, but household air pollution is ranked 7th. So household air pollution is in fact a larger burden of health than general ambient particulate matter. That's what this study says. And now I need to move on to a cost-benefit study that one of my students did to say, well, given what we know about the health impacts, what would the effect be if we applied the new plant minimum emission standards to all the major combustion sources on the Highveld? So if we went to the Highveld and we installed flue gas desulfurization, which is what is going to be required to remove the SO2, to all the power plants and to the Sasol plants. And she did this by using the concept of externalities, which all the colleagues on this side will know quite well. Externalities, the environmental consequences of an action that are not included in a conventional economic analysis. So it doesn't appear on the balance sheet of the companies. And can we quantify such off-balance sheet contributions? And we, in fact, can. She classified the externalities, and it is worthwhile, I think, just going through this list. The Class 1 externalities are the capital and operating cost of the mitigation. In other words, we're going to install flue gas desulfurization. That means we have to install new plant. Also, we have to run that plant, and that plant runs on water and lime, so we have to provide the lime. But, and we have a beneficial impact on health impacts around the plant. Now, the first two are actually quite easy to quantify. Health impacts are not so easy to quantify. It's an area of uncertainty. There is some agreement on what we should do, but not everybody agrees, and I'll tell you what the approach was that we used. There are some other ecological impacts. For instance, the impact on wildlife, which we were simply unable to quantify. We didn't have sufficient information. There was some Class 3 externalities. We have information about what the impact of high SO2 concentrations on crop yield is, but we could not quantify that. We could simply make a note that there is such an impact, but we couldn't quantify it. And then there's a Class 4 externality where we said, well, we don't know enough about it, but it is probably too small to actually try to quantify. And for the calculation of the benefits of the mitigation, you have to quantify the exposure, and we did that by dispersion modeling, which I've already referred to, which is a mathematical way of calculating what people are exposed to due to a specific source of pollution. And we did that using a model called CalPUF, which is the model which the department wants us to use when we do dispersion modeling over large areas. And then we have, when we know what the concentration at ground level is to be, we have fairly good information about what the health impact, both morbidity, in other words, disease related, and mortality is. In other words, how are people's lives, lifetimes reduced or lifespans reduced by exposure to those pollutants. So we can calculate the additional life years that occur because of the mitigation that you're going to install. And then quantifying that is always an area of debate. It seems almost repulsive to try to assign a value to a human life. But for economic reasons, there are ways of doing that. Unfortunately, we don't have good figures for South Africa, so what we did here is to use European and United States numbers and just using the GDP ratio convert them to South African numbers. And we valued the mortality impacts and the morbidity impacts. And this is a summary of the results. I apologize for the figures on this side not converting right, but I think the conclusion is here. It says the net present value is negative 166 billion rand. That means that if we were to implement the calculation says, calculation predicts, that if minimum emission standards for new plant were applied to all the major power stations and industries in that area, the economy as a whole would lose 166 billion rand, the net present value. So what you have to say then is that economically, according to the figures that we have on the table here, this is not justified. Again, I must stress here that I'm not denigrating the value of a human life. I'm talking about an economic calculation here, looking at what it would cost to implement flue gas desulfurization on all the plants and what the benefit would be in economic terms of implementing such mitigation steps to all the plants. Immediately the question comes, well, can you do it on some of the plants only? And we did that calculation as well, using the plant with the highest impact or the predicted highest impact, and the benefit there was marginal. So my conclusions are that not allowing postponements under the Air Quality Act Section 21 regulations will not ensure compliance with ambient air quality standards by itself. In other words, that is at least not the only thing that you have to do. The contribution of the different sources, those activities that we refer to ambient exposure, is location dependent. That is what I tried to demonstrate when I looked at the results of the Vol priority area study. And then the conclusion that I must come to is that enforcement of the new plant emission standard is not necessarily the most economically efficient method to reduce ambient exposure. We've said that we've had exposure to general ambient air pollution, but also to household air pollution, and that the contribution of household air pollution to health impacts is probably larger than that of the general ambient. So if the offsets, and I've just given the definition of the offsets as taken from the department's guideline on offsets, that are defined as measures that counterbalance, counteract, or compensate for an adverse impact of an activity. So typically what you would do is you would say to this major source, well, if you can find another way of reducing the impact of your pollution on ambient air quality, we would regard that as an offset, like a compensation measure. And what it seems to me is that offsets, especially those targeted at energy supply in low-income residential areas, may provide similar reduction in the impacts than enforcement of the minimum emission standards. Yes, before I get to the last slide, let me just say that I recognize that implementation of the minimum emission standards will save lives and will improve people's quality of life. What I am saying is that if we are going to spend the sort of money that is required to implement the minimum emission standards on the major emitters on the Highveld, there might be more economically efficient ways of spending that money. If we spend that money on mitigating the effect of the low-level sources in high-density, low-income residential areas, we might get the same benefits for a lower cost. I would think that to do that, one would have to look at the offset guidelines that have been prepared by the department, and they would probably have to be made more specific in terms of the measures that need to be taken as offsets and also the timelines that would need to be adhered to in implementing those offsets. My view again, and maybe this is a personal view, that says the DEA strategy that has been published to address air pollution in dense low-income settlements should be prioritized. If we can drive that strategy and make meaningful or take meaningful steps in terms of that strategy, that might be economically more efficient than implementing the minimum emission standards. And a case, I think, might be made for adding certain categories to the listed activities. There are activities that are taking place in South Africa that contribute materially to ambient air pollution, but that do not appear in the list. Thank you, Chair. I think that's the end. I don't know whether we're going to take questions now or at the end.
Thank you very much, Prof. We are running a little bit out of time, so I will allow the department to present, and then we can then ask questions, make comments, and basically engage with the presentations.
Thank you, Chair. Good morning, Honourable Chair. Good morning, Honourable Members. Good morning, Deputy. Good morning, colleagues and other members. I'm going to present with my team. I have Vumile, who will take us through the part of the postponements. I will start with the overview as written in the agenda to look at the air quality monitoring trends in the target areas and a little bit on some of the emissions that contribute to
Can you please speak to the mic? You are not audible enough.
I was saying I'm going to talk about the air quality monitoring trends in the priority areas, and I'm going to then hand over to my colleague, Vumile, who's going to talk specifically on the postponements that were granted, each one of them, what the rationale for the application was, and the considerations that we made to deal with those. So there are three priority areas that have been declared by the Minister. In terms of the Air Quality Act, there's a provision, Section 18, that says when the ambient air quality standards are in non-compliance, the Minister may declare that area a national priority area and then prepare an air quality management plan which needs to be implemented to address the problem. The MEC has the same provision for provinces in the event that such conditions exist. Or the MEC, if it's a provincial priority area, can also ask the minister to declare it as a national priority area, even though it may be within a province. At the moment, we've got three national priority areas. The first one is the blue one, the small one. It's small in area extent, but not small in terms of impact. It's the Vaal Triangle Eshat priority area, which covers the Sasolburg area and some of the municipalities there, and goes a little bit into Gauteng province, city of Joburg, on the Orange Farm, Soweto side. And then we've got the Highveld priority area, which covers the Mpumalanga province and part of the Gauteng province. Guruland is part of the Hafer Pirate area, is the metro that sits within that pirate area, and it goes all the way up to Middleburg and Secunda on the other side. And then we've got the Waterberg Bojanala pirate area, which was the last one to be declared as a precautionary measure when government started to plan having a development in the Waterberg area, to say we want to manage the air proactively and avoid the situation that we have in the other priority areas. And perhaps just to go back a bit, thanks Professor Cornelius for taking us through the legislation. All these things are provided for in the legislation, and we are implementing the act. This is just a slide that I took just to show the type of sources of pollution we have in the country. There is agricultural emissions, which a professor has spoken about. There's industry, there's mining, and then there's indoor. And there are natural sources, like we've seen the fires in Knysna, which, you know, there are such natural sources in South Africa, and there are areas in the country that are very dry, which then, when you have to develop ambient air quality standards, you have to consider the background levels that exist in the country. Because, yes, we use the WHO guidelines, but they are guidelines, and they are based on European conditions, which do not exist in most of the African countries. We have very dry and long winters sometimes, especially this time of the drought, and those create background levels that are much higher than you would find anywhere in the world. And when we develop our policy statements, we consider those things as well. So I just wanted to put this slide as an overview of what sort of drivers we have in the country that contribute to the pollution problem that we are dealing with. We have population growth indeed, urbanization and migration. This may not be understood as a source, you know, as an activity that creates a burden for pollution, but it is. When people move, we have population growth, it puts an increasing demands on our natural resources and all of that. And moving to one city, we have at the moment vehicle emissions emitting is a very significant source of air pollution in the cities, because the population of vehicles is growing massively, and it just puts pressure on the system. We have economic indices, we have transportation, which I've just started, touched on, we have energy use, both formal and informal energy use, and we have biomass burning, which is uncontrolled. But perhaps just to talk a bit on biomass burning, we get a lot of particulate matter transported into the country that for the fires that burn up north in Angola and those other countries that come straight into the high pressure system of the high field, and we measure it in our ambient air quality monitoring stations. We have mining activities, which are a significant source, mostly also because they emit at the breathing zone, open cast mining and all those kinds of sources, and the dust hold from the activities, and is currently a very significant source because it's growing unprecedentedly in some of the areas. We have residential fuel use, which we have a strategy draft that is going to be put through cabinet process again next calendar year. And we have other methods that I think we'll get into when you look at some of the postponement decisions, how we have brought in the offsets into that to address the problems that we face. So we have emission estimation protocols that exist scientifically in the space of air quality, which Professor has called mathematical dispersion modeling. That's one way we use to put the sources together, looking at the ambient conditions and met conditions, and project where the impact would be and what levels of impact those would be, and then influence the regulatory framework. Obviously, when you know better, you must do better. And then we make recommendations on the basis of it. This is just a slide in draft. What we see as a total for emissions, I've spoken about the emission sources that we have. And I'm glad that Professor spoke about the difference and relationship between an emission itself and what gets to the breathing zone of the people. I'm not going to rehash that. But these are the main sources of pollution in South Africa. I'm now going to zoom into the ambient air quality monitoring. This is a slide for PM10 from the Vaal Shared Priority Area. and it shows monitoring as far back as 2007 and how far we've come. This is particulate matter, PM10, the larger particles, not the 2.5. We have seen improvements, not significant enough to take us to the area of compliance, and I think that's the point DG that we need to emphasize, that this problem was created over a very long period of time, and there are natural sources as well. So when we see an improvement in what we're measuring in the station, we think that that is an achievement because we are moving in the right direction. We've not reached compliance, but we are moving in the right direction. And particulate matter is a serious pollutant that we need to focus on in South Africa for some of the reasons that the professor has given. But you see in some of the stations, for example, the Zamdela station in 2016, we are measuring higher pollution than we have before. This is normal. It has happened in other countries who've gone before us as well, that you do get episodes of higher measurements than what you had in the previous year. And natural phenomena like extended drought or winter period affect these things because you get more dust entrained into the atmosphere, which the station would pick up, but also other activities also add to that. So I have prepared diurnal seasonal cycles. This show the morning throughout the day to the afternoon and how we measure the pollution in the different seasons. The way to explain this slide, if I can draw the attention to the Sharpeville slide, which is the bottom left. When you see a morning peak and an afternoon peak, it shows that there are sources that are intermittent. They come in the morning, pump out the pollution to the atmosphere, go down during the day, and come back in the evening. This pollution signature is usually associated with vehicle emissions or domestic burning, where people make fires in the mornings and in the evenings. But when you see the graph elevated, the Sharpeville one, up to 80 milligrams on a daily basis, it means that there is background pollution that sits there in the environment. When the sources come in and out, they are not starting from zero. There's already background pollution that exists in the environment. And when I get to the Highveld, there's a graph that shows a clear signature for industrial emissions. I think for me that the challenge is to study this in the scientific context that it is in, to understand the types of sources that we are dealing with, and then to develop targeted intervention strategies to address each one of the sources, because the interventions would not be the same. And also just to show that in the winters, our winters in South Africa, we have elevated levels of pollution that we are measuring. And there are two reasons for this. The first one is that the sources themselves increase in the winter, because even people who don't burn wood and coal in the summer would burn in the winter because it's colder. They want to keep warm. But the second reason is a natural phenomenon which is called the inversion layer. I often make the example of when you boil water in a pot. The water that is in the bottom of the pot gets hot quicker, and then it becomes less dense, it goes up. Cold water comes down, gets warmer, goes up like that, and that is the convention that takes place in a boiling pot. It is the same because the air is just at a lesser, it's the same exactly in the air. So when the surface of the earth heats up, the hot air goes up, and so it goes. What happens in the winter is that the surface of the earth cools quicker than the air passes above. So that mixing stops immediately, and all the pollution that has been emitted sits stuck there until the morning when the sun rises again and heats up the surface, and then the pollution mixes again. So it is that double problem of more sources and then the pollution being trapped because of the winter conditions. It is common. I think people would have seen that in winter you see more, you know, smoke trapped. There's a scientific explanation for that. And when you look at the PM2.5, this is the more toxic one because it gets to the lungs. We still have that problem of elevated levels of PM2.5, improvements in some stations up and down, but we are working on addressing this problem. When we look at PM2.5, then it's a completely different picture. You see, you look at Diepkloof, there's a peak during the day, which is clearly a high-level source, clip reveal shows a constant high level of PM, which is obviously not an intermittent source, as you would see in the summer, which would be attributed clearly to vehicle emissions, just to show that there are different ways of understanding what the sources of pollution are. And of course, there's then other methods like wind roses that show you which direction the wind that came to the station came. Then you can begin to understand if the pollution, if when the wind is coming from this direction, you get higher levels of pollution and what, therefore, would be the sources at a high level. Sulfur dioxide is not being exceeded at the moment, but we do still focus on interventions to improve, to reduce emissions of sulfur, because the sulfur emissions contribute to the secondary formation of the sulfate aerosol, which we measure in PM2.5. In other countries, they say, when you look at their strategies, they started seeing improvements in PM2.5 when they addressed sulfur dioxide. So it is not a pollutant, even though there's no exceedance of the annual standard. There are accidents daily, but we still focus on sulfur dioxide for the reason that it causes secondary pollution in the atmosphere. I'm not going to spend too much time on the sulfur dioxide, but you can see if you look at Sharpeville, for example, it's clearly an industrial signature. It is not a low-level source. You can see during the day there's more pollution being recorded. It's different from the deep cloof of morning and afternoon peak, which is also different for different seasons if you look closely at that. And Zamdela as well. The hyperpyrite area measurements also show increased levels of PM10, high levels, with improvements when you look at MLO, Hendrina, and Middleburg, we're seeing improvements, but Secunda and Middleburg have recorded increases. And I mean, there are many reasons for this. One of the things that we've seen directly is the increase in traffic in the area, as well as the increase in mining, but there are obviously other sources of pollution that one could look at. The signatures are clear here. Where we put our stations, we are seeing a morning and evening peak, which I've explained. I'm not going to go into that again. PM2.5 remains an issue, with some improvements measured in MLO, Hendrina, and Middleburg again, which we still are working on. Seasonal variations for the HPA PM2.5 are very, very clear, with the winter still being the highest for the reasons I have mentioned earlier. But the background levels, if you look at Hendrina, already very, very high, because obviously the background level, if you look at Hendrina, is higher than any of the levels that you measure during the other seasons. Again, sulfur dioxide, we seem to have conquered it, but as I say, a non-exceedance does not mean that it is not significant pollution in the environment. Seasonal variations for sulfur dioxide, if you look at Secunda, you can see a clear Secunda and Hendrina, Middleburg, they show a clear signature of an industrial or high-level source. In Minister's declaration of the Waterberg Bojana priority area, we understood it to be a proactive declaration that we would be doing this before the environment, the air becomes strained, but what we are measuring is that there are already exceedances of the PM10 standard as it is, even before some of the development that is planned to come, and mainly attributed to low-level mining sources, but we do have a few industries in the area. PM2.5 is the same, and sulfur dioxide, again, is low. So we don't take the argument that because the ambient air standard is not being exceeded, therefore we should just allow sources for the reason that it leads to secondary pollution that leads to other problems in society. I think maybe let me just do this slide on the postponements, the provisions that exist in the law, and then I'll hand over to my colleague. So in terms of the, I think Professor spoke about what a new plant is and what an existing plant is in terms of the standard. So a new plant is one that has not existed until 1st of April to 2010, yes, for which an EIA has not even been submitted. But for those that had an EIA by then, they were all taken as existing plants, which would be explain, for example, why Medupi Power Station is an existing plant in terms of the definition of an existing plant standard. And the reason for that is before you apply for an EIA, you would have completed your design for the plant. So it is therefore an existing plant. We make a requirement for those same plants to come into compliance with new plant standards But the way the legal framework is that it is an existing plan standard according to the definition, and it's not the only one. I'm just using that one because it's a well-known. So in terms of what the law provides for, far back in 2007, it existed in the national framework, and the provisions are clear that because there hasn't been a full cost-benefit analysis, like Professor has said, the initial list of activities was to take what was regulated under the APA of 1965 and make sure it's regulated in the Equality Act of 2004. So that was the shift, making sure that in the new legal framework, everything that was legislated is legislated. And those provisions, therefore, to say the plants are not the same size, they're not the same magnitude, they would not have the same amount of time to invest towards compliance. So the department made provision to give those plants, as they are investing towards compliance, time to do so and get into compliance. That's why it is called postponement of compliance time frame. You will not be able to comply today, but here is a date at which you can comply. And this is the function that is given to the National Equality Officer with the concurrence of the licensing authority. And perhaps just to go back to the constitution here, the function is across the three spheres of government. The municipalities and metros are the, and provinces are the implementers of the act. So for example, once the minister has established an ambient equality standard, they have a duty to monitor and report compliance for that standard and implementing some of the aspects of the Equality Act. And the reason this legal framework is framed like this is that the National Equality Officer has a coordination function with the other equality officers that are set out in the Act in the different spheres of government. And so these decisions have to be done with the licensing authority for that plant because they are the ones managing the plants on a day-to-day basis. And therefore, there is not, in terms of the spheres of government, one authority that is responsible for that decision. They, of course, has to be accountability, so the National Equality Officer does that accounting, but the decisions themselves are taken with the other authorities. The provision that we have at the moment is that no postponement may exceed 5 years. So we have some decisions that are for 5 years maximum, but some were a year or two, depending on the time frames that the industries needed to come into compliance with that. And there is also a provision that a postponement can be withdrawn upon good cause provided. So not because you don't like someone, but if there's good cause for withdrawing a postponement, you could do that. The legal framework is very clear on what that good cause would constitute. I've spoken to this. So at the time when we, in 2014, when we received the applications, we had 34. And when we were in Parliament, we had decisions for 32. We had two that were pending because the applicants had not given the additional information that we needed. So now I will hand over to Vumile. But since then, we have received an additional 20 new applications for different reasons, which Vumile will go to when he talks to each one of the applications that we handled. Thank you.
Good morning, Honorable Chair, Honorable Members, as well as the DG and all of those in attendance. As indicated, I'm Vumile Sanene from the Department. My task today, it is to take you through the postponements application that we received, as well as the justifications and reasons that were advanced by the applicants, and of course what informed then our decision based on the information provided to us. Before I do so, I'll just like to highlight a couple of things pertaining to the process itself. As indicated by the NAQA, the postponement had to be addressed on a case-by-case basis. And also, we had to look at individual installations within that particular facility, but also go further down and consider each pollutant that the application was made for. And the reason being that each particular pollutant would require a typical intervention that would have its own technological requirements. And so you could not then blanket all of them together under one. And so what you have before you, I think it's over 100 slides that I am tasked to go through and present, as requested, that we would look each and every postponement. So I will try and lump some of them that I can do that for, but it is not possible because they were quite specific in terms of the requirements. So the first slide talks to the applications, the first batch that was received prior to the Act or the Section 21 coming into effect on the 1st of April 2015. So these applications were to be submitted by the 31st of March 2014. So I won't go through all of them. I hope that you would have the presentation. You can see, but to highlight that the majority of the 34 were related to Eskom power stations, and the majority which were located in the Mpumalanga province. And the other one that I can also mention in terms of the number as well, related to the Sasol sites, which we had applications from the Sasol back to Secunda, and another one in the city of Tshwane. And so that will take us through the first batch. Quite a few of these other applications related to fuel storage facilities, which I will not go through them in their entirety. As the NACO has also indicated, there were additional applications that were received post-2015, and I think they're currently number at 20, and they are indicated as above. And so that list continues. So if I can just go through the justifications and reasons for postponements. As indicated by the NACWA, it was clear during the development of the standards that some facilities would not, within the 5 and 10 years provided for in law, be able to comply with the standards. And I often call the 5 and 10 years as a blanket postponement for all facilities in the country. Some had negotiated for a longer blanket postponement to cater for their own specific needs and circumstances, but the department was clear that the 5 and 10 years would remain fixed. Anybody who needed additional time would need to come forward then and advance the reasons as to why then the 5 and 10 years would not be sufficient for them. And based on the considerations then, a decision will be made as to whether that postponement will be granted or not. And let me also indicate, Chair, that during this time, there were a few of the applications that were declined because the justifications and reasons that were provided were not satisfactory to the department, and you will see them highlighted as I go through. So if I can start with Anglo-American Platinum, there were two applications that were received that pertained to Bologwane and Mortimer smelters. And the justification that was given for this particular application, okay, let me start first of all with a period that they were looking for. They were looking for a postponement with the compliance with the existing plant standards between 2015 to 2020. And the pollutant of concern was SO2. And their justification and reason for this was that rather than working towards the 2015 standard first, doing some work investing, and then further onwards, again investing, they would rather have this novel technology that would allow them to have one significant improvement and investment in the technology, and then work towards the 2020 limit. And I think what was clear at the time was that the limit that was given, which was a negotiated limit for 2015, they were quite far above it. And for them to be able to comply with that 2015 limit, unlike other facilities who could comply, theirs would need more investment. And that was the reason that was justified. And so their commitment was that by 2020, they would be able to comply with the new plant standards. And so having considered that information and where the facility was, their compliance history, it was determined that it was reasonable for them to be granted the postponement and for them to work towards that particular 2020 limit with the technology that was given to us. And there were quite a number of issues that were discussed in the process, and eventually a limit was granted of 30,000 milligrams per normalized cubic meter between 2015 to 2020. Now, Honorable Chair, as I indicated, there are quite a few of these. And so I will be at your mercy and guidance as to how much of all of these 100 and odd slides you would like me to go through. But I'm now going to go through to the next one, which was the engine refinery at Thekwini. And basically, they were looking for a number of
listed
activities.
Can I interject you? There's 37 applications. How much time do you need to deal with each one of them? Or to group them, if possible?
As I indicated, Chair, I can group probably the ESCOM, which is quite a huge number. To some extent, I can group the storage facilities, the total, the shelf. I can group them. The justifications and reasons were very similar. But for the rest, unfortunately, you would have to go each by each because they're quite specific. And I think the worst case scenario would be for Sasol, because all three facilities were quite different. And what we had to do was to go each and every single unit to justify why that particular unit. And the decisions were different. So they were quite different for each.
Okay. Try to do that in the next 20 minutes. And
20
see.
Minutes. I will do my level best.
Okay.
Okay. So quickly then, with regards to the engine refinery, their concern really related to the change in the legislation. And I must just indicate that when we published the 2010 notice, we realized there were some few amendments that needed to be made. So prior to the Act coming into effect in 2014, there was another notice that was sent out. And that notice had a significant impact on this facility and its preparation towards compliance with the 2015. And so as a result of that, their plans were thrown out a little bit. And that's when they came to us and requested that as a result of this change in legislation, and there were quite a few facilities affected in that banner, they requested that we would need to grant them postponement for at least those activities that you see. I will not go through all of them. And based on that justification and reason, and as well as the plans they had in place to comply with the 2020 limit, a decision was taken that it would actually be advisable to give them this postponement. But as you can see, the time frames are different for each of the specific units and the pollutants. So it was not all of them until 2020. Some of them were 2019, others 2016, as you can see. So that's how far it as it pertains to engine refinery. When we go to Chevron, Chevron advanced very similar reasons as well to engine in terms of their combustion installations and the storage and handling of petroleum products. And they requested that they be granted a postponement for SO2 and the total volatile organic compounds. And I think what was critical with this particular category, you'll see with the others as well, is that with respect to the storage tanks, the number of storage tanks they have in their facility and the extent of the work required to do any work, if you have around 50 or 60 of these storage tanks, it's quite a significant amount of work, and you cannot necessarily shut them all down at the same time to do the work. So it has to be staggered over a period of time. Again, in this particular case, there were limits that were given during this period, because our understanding and our view was that even during a postponement period, you should still be given a limit, and that limit should not be above your historical performance. So we hold you to your historical performance. And in some instances, we were actually a little bit stricter in terms of those emission limits. And so with the Chevron refinery, we granted, as indicated, the decision based on that particular concern around the change in legislation. And then now with regards to Chevron refinery, and this time around it's their storage facility in Nelson Mandela Bay, they were granted a postponement from 2016 to 2020. With regards to, again, as I indicated, the issue of storage facilities and the implication of systematically over time sequencing the upgrades that were needed for these storage facilities. The difficulty they had in actually not being able to do them all at once. With ESCOM, as I indicated, Chair, I'll try as much as I can to lump the ESCOM issues and to indicate that across the majority of the power stations, we were looking at three pollutants in essence. We were looking at PM, SO2, and NOx. And across all these stations, where we found that there was a lot of room to maneuver around, to be strict in terms of the emission standards themselves, the technology that could be installed, it was around particulate matter. And this is where, as a department, you will see across, in some instances, we declined the application for postponement for PM because of the view that we have in terms of what can be done by the facility. And I think I will not be speaking out of turn if I say some of the issues that we picked up really were related to poor maintenance, and that if maintenance was done properly, there could be compliance. In those instances, we did not budge on the compliance with the minimum emission standards. Where we saw a bigger challenge was pertaining to the SO2. And as the Prof indicated, the shift from 3,500 all the way to 500 is a significant shift. And the technology required, there's little room to maneuver. In essence, it's an FGD that must be installed. But also with SO2, we realized that even prior to us setting the 3,500 limit, it was clear that because SO2 could not be mitigated other than installing an FGD, you were really held to the sulfur content in the fuel. And because it varied from one area to the next area, these power stations exhibited different patterns of SO2 levels. And that also came into the decision in terms of seeing what can this power station be able to achieve with the kind of coal that it has, and looking back now historically over time and so forth. And then the other one, of course, with NOx. Now, NOx is inherent in the oxygen, in the air that is used in the power station. And either you have a low NOx burner, or you have very high levels of NOx. And so some of these facilities had plans to install low NOx burners. And so I will not then go through in detail which each and every single limit for each particular pollutant, but to indicate that for the majority of the power stations, the SO2 limits were granted, some not for 2015 to 2020, but for 2020 to 2025. Because some of them could still comply with the 2015 limit while others could not. And so if you look at Acacia, the power station in Buffalo City really was a peaking station that was planned to be decommissioned. We looked at the ambient air quality and so forth. And what was decided there was that a limit would be imposed of 750 between 2015 to 2020. And so if you look at the Arnold Power Station, again, having summarized all the issues pertaining to this, we granted for SO2 a limit of 2,500 between 2015 to 2020. NOx, it was 1,200. On the PM, we did not grant a PM postponement for that, and we expected them to comply with the 2015 limit, as well as also they indicated they could even comply with the 2020 limit. And so, Honorable Chair, I will quickly go through these ones. And the reasons also are specific here. We didn't grant PM in this particular case. We granted SO2. We granted the NOx as well. If you go to Duva Power Station, we didn't grant the request for that PM. We granted for SO2 as well as NOx with those limits that are given there. If you go to the Hot Flame Power Station, also, In this particular case, there were staggered emission limits for different time periods, because our analysis led us to believe that improvements in maintenance can actually lead to compliance, and those were the limits that were given to that particular power station. If you go to Henrena, we didn't grant PM, we granted SO2, we granted NOx, but also if you note with the SO2, it was not for the 2015 limit, it was for the 20 limit, because currently they were in compliance with that particular limit. And so Kendal Power Station, already, again, we didn't grant PM, we granted SO2, but even for that, it was for the new plant standards going forward. And for NOx, we didn't grant that because there was no need for that. They were already in compliance. If you go to Komati, very similar situation. PM, we left alone and looked at the other pollutants. So quickly going to Creel. Again, Creel, we granted the 2015 limit, but we gave them 125. And the rest remained the same then for NOx and SO2. Letabo Power Station was also another interesting one where they were granted for a couple of months to comply with the 2015 limit, and thereafter they could be able to comply going forward. And then we granted for 2020 the SO2 limit of 2,500, and then granted for 2020 the limit of 1,100. The implication then is they are currently in compliance with the the existing plant standards. So if I go quickly to Matimba, we declined the PM, we granted the SO2, and we declined the NOx. If I go to Matla, similar situation there. With the NOx, we granted the 2015 to 2020, the SO2, it was the 2020 to 2025, so they are currently in compliance with the existing plant standards. And then with PM, we actually split the units. One set of units could comply and the others could not, and so we made an arrangement as to which one will comply with the 200 limit that we had given them. Okay, so with Medupi Power Station, again, there was no decision for PM. For SO2, because they are currently in compliance with the 2015 limits, it was the 2020 that was considered, and no decision on the NOx. Podrex, which is another picking station, the only one that really was of an issue, it was the NOx. The other two were fine. It was the NOx. Again, it was only the 2020 limit and not the 2015 limit. Tutuga Power Station, this is one of those as well that we had to stagger the compliance because we felt that certain actions could actually improve the situation. And so we granted the postponement as indicated in that particular block. And then for SO2, we granted the 2020 to 2025 limit, as well as for NOx, the 2015 to 2020 with a limit of 1,200. If we go to PPC quickly, PPC, if my memory serves me well, there were four of these sites. So in the West Coast District Municipality, there was one particular, there were a couple of mills that had an issue. It was basically the PM in that particular area. We granted the 2015 limits, and we gave them 100 from 2015 to 2016. It was not for the full 5 years, only a year granted for that. In this particular case in Dwaalboom, they were granted the PM postponement, and it was until December 2016 with a limit of 200. So it was only a period of a year that they needed to address the issues that they had. If we come to PPC in Port Elizabeth, again, they didn't need the full 5 years. There were some issues that they needed to address that needed a couple of years. And so for KIN 4, they were given a postponement for a period of 3 years with a limit of 100 milligrams per normalized cubic meter. And then from there until December 2016 for MIL 4, they were granted a limit of 400. And then PPC Slurry, again, it was particulate matter. And I must indicate, Chair, that in this particular case, all the other pollutants, I think 8 or 7 of them in this particular facility were in compliance. So So the issue really was PM, and so that's what we focused on. And so they were granted a postponement from 2015 to December the 31st, 2018, for Raw Mill 3 with a limit of 250, and then for Kiln 7, it was a limit of 350. If we go to Sasol, as I indicated, this was quite a complex one. I will not go to the detail each and every single one of them, but in the packs that you have, you will see that the first one that we dealt with was the Sasol Nitro in the city of Tshwane, where we basically declined this particular postponement request because we were of the view that the request they made really pertained to an issue that can be addressed through better planning and maintenance, and so that it didn't need a postponement to address that particular issue, and hence we declined it. Now, if we go to Sasol Thin Fuels, and this is where it gets very, very complex and detailed, I'll do my level best to talk to this, but there are quite a few categories that they brought to us for compliance and for postponement issues. So if you look at the first one, subcategory 3.6, synthetic gas production and cleanup, you will see that there were quite a few of those pollutants that they applied for 2015 to 2020, and those were the decisions that we made relating to the application itself. And the issue really talked to the adequate time due to the complex nature of the facility itself. Most of the other pollutants, as I've indicated in some instances, were already in compliance. So these were the ones that they were still not in compliance. So there are quite a few relating to this particular site that you can be able to go through. The justifications and reasons remain the same right throughout. And there were some of these thermal treatment hazardous facilities that needed also to be addressed. The other site is Sasol Infrachem or Sasol Beck, where also with some of the incinerators, there were some issues that related to very high temperatures in terms of measurements and so forth that we needed to consider. So I will not go through those as well. But as you can see, each and every single pollutant was analyzed, assessed, and a decision was taken for each and every single one. The time frames are not always the same. They change because of the details of the justifications and reasons. So there were quite a few of these incinerators that they requested the postponement for. So if I go to Natref, also in Fezile Dabi, again, those are the reasons that were given, again, to the complex nature of the facility, but also in this particular case, the design itself. In Equality, we manage individual stacks and we set limits for individual stacks. But the design of this facility was that all multiple sources went through one stack, and it became difficult to set a limit for 5 or 6 units going through one stack. And so the requirement was for them to disintegrate these and allow them to be measured individually. And that whole process required some significant time. So what we did then was to negotiate a limit for this one stack where all these other sources feed into it during the period of postponement, which was up to 2018. And then thereafter, we expect them now to measure and monitor these units separately. So it's an issue of design, past design, that we had to address going forward. So that is Natref. Now I'm going to go through this very quickly. The justifications and reasons around this, again, talks to the storage facilities. They were very similar for Shell, for BP, as well as for Total. So I will not go through them in their entirety, but as you can see, the time frames that they requested were very short in terms of addressing the issues that they had to install the vapor recovery units in these particular storage facilities. And the reasons advanced to us were quite understandable, and looking at the investments they'd done and the roadmaps they'd given to us. And so quickly going through all of them, they are very similar, time frames very similar as well. The pollutant being managed is exactly the same. So it's just different sites in Ladysmith, in Polokwane, in Port Elizabeth, exactly the same approach. total, as I indicated. I'm just planting them quickly. Very same advanced reasons and the processes that needed to be undertaken. And on these ones now, quantum crushing. This was one of the new applications that came after the first batch that we had processed. And in this particular case, they were looking to convert one of the existing two plants into a similar cleaner efficient system so that they can be able to comply with the standards. And the objective will ensure that the entire operating facility gets cleaner and more efficient and ultimately help with the environment, both directly and indirectly. And so they were granted a decision of a limit of 6,276 for PM for a period until 2020. A compliance of 50 milligrams is applicable beyond that, which is a commitment to comply with the new plant standards thereafter. Okay, so Chevron, Port Elizabeth, very similar. In this particular case, this facility was moving to the new IPZ, so it didn't make sense for them to invest in the current facility, seeing that a new up-to-date facility was being built, and so they were granted a cost permit based on that, as the new facility to be in compliance with the 2020 limits. BPSA, very similar again in terms of the storage facility, the justifications and reasons that were given, and the technology that was required. Same thing with the City of Cape Town, East London. And then quickly going to this other facility, silicon smelters, Rand Carbon in Kangala District Municipality. They indicated that a lot of work had been done in order to come into compliance with the standard. However, the controls that they had were not appropriate for the technology and have proven inadequate to meet the limits. And so they were requesting then more time to be able to install the appropriate technology. And as a result, they were then given the postponement until 2019. With the applicable emission limits, the same for SO2. The other one that we were dealing with is AL Mining in the City of Johannesburg. This facility was late for applying for postponement, and as part of a settlement between them and the department, they were given a fine, and part of the settlement was that we would process the application, and then they were granted those postponements as indicated. There are quite a few of them. It's quite a complex facility as well. But again, we went to each and every individual unit, every pollutant, to make a decision, as you can see in those boxes there. The other one that we had was Vanken Vanadium. This was a company at the time that was going through, if my memory serves me well, it was going through some financial challenges, and they were under, I forget the term now, business rescue, and so it had an implication on the postponement itself and the application thereafter, but once they sorted their issues out, we were able then to grant them the postponement as indicated there. Ilovo Sugar Mill Ilembe, what happened here is that the facility was going through an innovative emission and fossil fuel carbon reduction plans over the last couple of years, and they had a renewable energy project, and some of the equipment and installations that they had will not only reduce emissions but also contribute to cleaner production. So in order for them to be able to install some of these technologies, they needed a little bit more time, and hence they applied for postponement, and they were given up to 2019 for them to facilitate this whole process of ensuring that they can comply with the standards. And so they were given 100 milligrams per normalized cubic meter for PM, and then thereafter the commitment to comply with the 2020. Very similar again for Ilovo. It was the very same facilities, just in different places, and of course in Ugu as well. On this one, Fossil Fuels, They had previously submitted a postponement application for existing plant standards. Now, the postponement decision for these tanks provided for this extension only to 2017. So the initial postponement period of 2 years granted for these tanks was shorter than the 5 years that they had asked for. We were of the view at the time in processing the applications that they could do it in 2 years. And so we were not happy to give them the 5 years. So they've come back to us and said, well, the 2 years that they were given was not enough. And they requested then the additional 3 years in order for them to be able to conclude this. And I must say, Chair, at the time, we were quite aggressive in our approach. We didn't feel that if a facility asked for 5 years, they should be granted 5 years automatically, where we believed that they needed less time, we pushed for the less time. So in some instances, they would come back to us and indicate that, well, the 5 years had not been, the 2 years had not been sufficient, and they needed the additional years. The other one is the Palaboro Copper, Mopani, in Mopani District Municipality. They applied for all those pollutants, as you can see, for their solid fuel burning appliances. They had dated technology. The life of mine planning was also considered. The feasibility of the retrofit was undertaken. What they indicated was that the complexity of the retrofit needed more time for them to be able to do the work. So as indicated, those were the reasons they gave us, and the decisions were granted as indicated on the right column. So the request was also to indicate what applications do we have currently with us. As indicated before, PPC Duwuk in the West Coast had applied initially for postponement, but they were granted until 2018. So they've come back to us again, and they've given those reasons why then they are requesting that they be given an additional postponement, because what had happened is that we gave them until 2018, and clearly some of the issues they are currently having require that this must be extended. So that one is currently pending. PPC Van Riebeek in the West Coast, this is a new one that was not in the original batch. And these are the reasons and justifications they're giving us in terms of this particular application, and that decision is still pending. With the Sasol Natreps in Fezile Derby, they also had applied previously for postponement, and they are back again now asking for an additional time, because initially they were given up to 2018, and these are the reasons they are advancing why then that initial decision until 2018 is not sufficient for them, and they are needing another time. So the same thing again for Fezile Derby, very similar as well with Sasol Fuel Fuels in Getsebande. Initially they were given until 2018. They are back now again saying that they need more time. The 3 years initially given to them was not sufficient. And as well as Eskom Matimba and Medupi in Waterberg, what happened in this particular case, Chair, again, going back to the initial decision, when Eskom applied at the time they put in the application, their information was based on periodic measurement. So these are measurements that are taken once every year. And so as part of the decision, you required them to monitor continuously. And so what has happened now is that the decision that we gave them was based on that particular information that was before us. But now that they've got more information based on continuous emission monitoring, it is clear that some of the limits that were set for them at the time may not necessarily be applicable to them. And so they are coming back to us now justifying why, for SO2 specifically now, we need to reconsider the decision that we granted them initially. The other request we had, Chair, was to give an update on the compliance of those that were already granted postponement as to how are they complying with the conditions of their postponement. So I'll quickly go through this as well. The information is before the portfolio committee, but as you can see, we were able to give you for the different applicants, Eskom, the power stations, what was the postponement granted, what was the limit, and what was the activity they needed to do, the progress they are reporting in our comment on the right. So it is a mixed chair in terms of some being able to comply, others being behind. We are already picking up some concerns in some units that they will not necessarily be able to meet the targets based on the progress that they're giving us. So I won't go to the details of each of these power stations, but that is a progress. Some are on track, some are falling behind. So that is as far as Eskom is concerned. With Shell, these facilities, some were able to comply, others have not been able, but others have been able to achieve the target as indicated or as promised. Others are still struggling with some issues. I won't go into the details. Same thing with PPC. You might have seen that others have already come back to apply for postponement. Others are on track. The others have already met the target. So the same here with engine on track. In other instances, the target has been achieved as promised. Total, they've achieved their targets. Anglo American is an interesting case in that in Mortimer, yes, they are on progress, but in Polokwane, they have taken us to court on that decision. Currently, that matter is under consideration in the High Court. So we are basically in limbo on this one until we deal with that legal challenge they have brought against us on this decision. Natref, as indicated there, is on track for most. Some have challenges, as you can see in the applications that have come back to us and have applied for additional postponements. Sasol Steel Fuels as well, it's a mix between the two. So the recommendations to the committee is that the committee notes the status of the applications for postponement of compliance timeframe for all activities whose applications have been considered and finalized by the NACON with the concurrence with the licensing authorities for the first batch, which was from the 1st of April 2014 to the 31st of March 2015. Also that the committee notes the status of postponement decisions and the reasons for granting the decisions, and they also the portfolio committee notes the compliance status of postponement holders and the current status of postponement applications that we have. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, thank you very much. Looks like there's one more. Presentation that is outstanding. Maybe we must just have a 2 minutes body break and then come back. It's very cold in this room. I've asked that the aircon must be switched on. So the technician apparently is working on it, but it does look like it has been switched off. So. Okay, just 2 minutes and then we'll be back.